level and also some funny side stories on what we experienced along the way.
Yeah,
my name is Florian Walter, or better known as Goosey, which is my hacker handle. I was for the CCC, I was an expert witness in the European Parliament hearing for this new cybercrime directive. That is why I'm here on stage with live today, because that topic is part of the presentation and some parts of it I will cover.
And we already gave this talk 2 weeks ago at Republika, but we thought we also give it again here for the special hacker community. Because you may have seen a couple of weeks ago there was a vote in the Civil Liberties and Home Affairs Committee of the European Parliament on this cybercrime directive, which raised a lot of eyebrows, and people were afraid that now their penetration testing tools are being criminalized and things like that. And I was like, okay, I tried like at least last summer to get some of the hackers active on this. I contacted CCC and others. There was basically no reaction, which is a bit sad. But then Scoozy came to the rescue. Okay, so there's different approaches to cybersecurity. This is the outline of the talk and also the outline of the different policy fields, you could say, information and coordination, then cybersecurity as part of the internal security strategy, a bit like the EU homeland security approach. Then there's a funny episode from a year ago about this idea of a virtual Schengen border. And part four is about this cybercrime directive, which is just at the moment being negotiated. So, information and coordination. This is mostly under Information Commissioner Nelly Kroes, Director General Information Society in the European Commission. The main agency here is the European Network and Information Security Agency, ENISA. This picture actually looks pretty impressive, right? But it's a technology park somewhere on Crete, in Greece. ENISA only has rented some office space there, so it's not the whole building.
So there are just 50 people.
That's what they put on their website. So this agency was set up by regulation in 2004, is operational since 2005 in Heraklion on Crete. Has at the moment about 50 staff. And in 2010, the Commission proposed a revision of the mandate of the agency to widen the scope of the activities and strengthen ENISA and so on. And then you already can see one funny thing in EU lawmaking. EU members of parliament are still members of their national parties and mostly accountable to the national public spheres. So a big part of the fight about the new mandate for ENISA was about the location. And people were complaining there are no direct flights to Brussels from Heraklion. There's no international school, so all the bureaucrats who have to go there can't send their kids to an English-speaking school and things like that. But only a small part of the debate was actually about the mandate. This is also part of how EU lawmaking works sometimes. So in the end, the deal they came up with was, okay, we do a compromise, we have also some staff in Athens, where there's direct flights to Brussels, and they also want to establish a small liaison team in Brussels. And, oh yeah, they also will get an international school. Greece is now building an international school for 500 school kids. Remember, they at the moment have 50 staff, so I don't know how many kids they have to produce. Yeah, but also the mandate will now be widened. They will now have the possibility to also cooperate with law enforcement agencies. We try to make sure in that context that they don't just become like the extended computer forensics body of Europol, but still keep their independency. But we think it still makes sense if they have some knowledge about ongoing attacks, botnets, whatever, that they also are able to share their knowledge with Europol and law enforcement agencies. And they are now supposed to coordinate CERTs EU-wide for incident response things. that's also one thing we tried to get in, actually achieved it. Because before that, there was no real body responsible for EU-wide coordination of CERs, computer emergency response teams. I know they have all these conferences where they always go and meet and have beer together and so on. It's already some kind of network of trust in the CERN community, but we thought it's a good idea to have one body responsible for coordinating that and also having resources for that. It was also one approach we had to make sure ELISA has to get the real nerds, you know, not just Eurocrats. So let's see if that works. Then another body is the EU CERT. That's basically the CERT for the EU institutions. So for example, in February, I think this year, the European Parliament was under DDoS attack from Anonymous because of ACTA, and because apparently they couldn't tell the difference between the European Council, which had just signed ACTA, and the European Parliament, which is the last option to stop ACTA, but whatever. So they have their CERT, which is supposed to be operational in June, and yes, yeah, some experience with that.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe some of you have read or heard about that thing. There was a story like a few months ago, like roughly 8 months ago or something like that, where people from Germany, Sicherheit Online is their website, they have found 40 plus vulnerabilities on ec.europa.eu, which is the server of the European Commission. There was SQL injections, you could go directly through to the backend, and, you know, funny things. Also some smaller bugs like cross-site scripting and that kind of things. And Gulli.com launched a story about it, that they have tried to inform the responsible persons at the European Commission to tell them that they have some security problems on their server, and they couldn't find anyone. So by accident, I was talking to the editor in chief of Gulli.com and read that story before online and told him, hey, if you need help, I could probably help you. I know some people in Brussels, and you know, should I go find out for you? Yes, please do so. Okay. So I went and found out. It took me like half a day to get the right guy on the get the telephone number of the right guy. After I had that, I learned that he's in holiday, but his deputy called me back, and I told him about this 40 plus vulnerabilities, and there was like, oh yeah, damn it, yeah, we are just the pre-configuration team, we are not operational yet, but we will try to find the right people, give us some days, and then, nothing happened, and yeah, in the end I became a really long email explaining them, or they explained me, yeah, we have now the right people, they promised to look into it, but we can't tell you if anything is going to happen, and they excused for not being operational, and talked a lot about the issues they have in setting up everything, getting resources and funding and whatnot. Yeah, I think it's not fixed until today. I haven't checked back.
I still have like 10 days left.
Yeah, maybe I should. Yeah, so this EU cert is coming up somehow, but yet not operational, and it does not look like they have really good incident management and problem management there in place. But okay, maybe this is coming like in the course of the next year or so. We will see.
And then the member states are also supposed to set up their own national CERTs. I think Germany already has one.
Bund.
For their state agencies and so on. But that's basically it. That's part of council conclusions from May 2011 from the Home Affairs ministers. And they basically say member states are supposed to set up their own national CERTs. But they don't say anything about how to help smaller member states with lack of resources and things like that. So basically, they're basically left to themselves.
Yeah, there's even more CERTs in Germany. The Bundeswehr has its own CERT, the BW CERT. And the most important. important CERT in Germany is not the Bund CERT and not the Bundeswehr CERT, but the DFN CERT, because all the German, or most of the German backbone from the DFN network is done by DFN CERTs, and since all the universities are connected there, they have much more incidents per day and per month as any other CERTs, and usually they are the first one that realize things, that getting an idea of ongoing attacks and so on.
Yeah, so this was chapter one, basically, where the EU was more or less success trying to work on coordination, information. ELISA is also commissioning research studies on cybersecurity aspects and so on. I would say in general it's not that bad, it doesn't lead to any harm, it could be done in a much more efficient way, and I'm not sure if they could do school for international school for 500 school kids in Greece, but whatever. A bit more problematic is chapter 2, the internal security strategy. You can already see it's under the responsibility of Directorate General Home Affairs, with Commissioner Malmström, and that's where you normally find where also repressive policies are coming from, data retention and so on. So cybersecurity is among the five priorities of the EU internal security strategy, among organized crime, terrorism, border security, and natural and man-made disasters. Based on the strategy, the Commission 2 years ago launched an action plan. That's basically what they want to do in the next few years. And one thing there, Malmström just recently announced, is a new cyber crime center, E3C. I think they got the number and character wrong, you know, normally it should be EC3. According to the CCC. Yeah, whatever. So Malmström just announced that recently. It shall be added to the already existing high-tech crime center at Europol, which is doing computer forensics and so on. And the cyber crime center, I think you want to say something about that, because you talked with Malmström about it.
Yeah, yeah. The European cyber crime center with E3C is interesting. Because I asked, okay, you have Europol, you have ENISA, what is this new organization for? Yeah, we need to get in touch with the private sector. We know by now we need to get the skills and the knowledge of the private sector, and this one is for, you know, work together with the private sector, so which means industry, basically. But they could not describe how that should work, how that should really taking place, how they gonna do it. Should those guys from the industry work there for half a year or for a few months, or do they just call in external consultants which they pay, or, you know, how should that work, and what they want to do is something they could not explain to me. So if even the commissioner who did that and who is politically responsible for it could not explain what the center does and how, makes me think.
Yeah, it's really, if you look at the press release and the commission communication on this from March, I think it's really like a long wish list, anything you can come up with in terms of what a cybercrime center could do, support for law enforcement, coordination with the CERTs and cooperation with private sector, information sharing and so on, reporting, collecting statistics. Everything, but it doesn't really fit together as a real strategy, I would say.
And you should not have more than one body or organization dealing in coordination of CERTs. Because, you know, that's gonna produce a fuck up, basically. If there's three entities that try to coordinate 23 same CERT units, that's never ever gonna work. They should have one entity that is responsible for it, and that entity should do it right, and more or less just that. And they have that entity already, ENISA. So it does not make sense that this new center is coordinating CERT stuff. But we also already ask ourselves if this is some hack, like that they try to get around restrictions that Europol has, for example, or things like that. Because they say the center is independent from Europol, but it will be at Europol in Den Haag, and it will work together with Europol people. So
So you can say within existing structures, so it's somewhat within Europol, but has a different supervisory authority, not the normal one from Europol. And the
money
budget
is coming from a different pool.
It's not coming from the normal Europol budget, but from the internal security fund.
Yeah, and people from the private sector and from Europol should work there. So, I don't know, but it looks a little bit strange, this construction to me. It looks odd.
So we will have to look at the budgetary and operational oversight. Let's see. Then there's also part of the action plan some work on resilience. There's a European Public-Private Partnership for Resilience, EP3C. I think here they got the P3 order right. They mainly work on definitions at the moment. They try to come up with a common definition of what a critical infrastructure is. Industry is asking the Commission, okay, what are the values that are core for the functioning of our societies? And if you tell us what kind of values we should protect, then we can tell you what kind of infrastructures need to be up and running 24/7. And the Commission is like, so yeah, let's see. I think the Commission at the end just wants some sheet with some tick boxes. Then a bit more shady in the cybersecurity action plan. You know, so far it was all about cybersecurity, protecting against hacker attacks and botnets and DDoS attacks and so on. But part of this in the internal security strategy is also the fight against illegal content, which I think is a totally different layer. And you could even ask if illegal content is really a part of the internal security strategy, if that should be like that.
It should not be there. You know, illegal content, they probably mean your MP3 collection, and it has nothing to do with cybersecurity.
Yeah,
it should not be there.
The intellectual property theft.
Yeah, yeah.
That was in the annual report on the implementation of the action plan that was presented by Malmström earlier this year, and we went through it. It's basically just 10 pages. Like, we did this and that and that. And then we found, okay, intellectual property, how should this be part of internal security, like homeland security, not exactly, and Malmström actually got beaten up for that in the committee session. But they are thinking also about radicalization, you know, websites that could be dangerous for your minds, could radicalize you, things like that. There will also be work on the notice and takedown guidelines this year. So that's something we actually have to watch out, or go watch and see if we can fight back the evil things. Then there's also some work on incident response, and it's mainly linked to the first chapter, so to speak, cooperation of national reserves, some information sharing alert system, and then, as I said, member states should develop national contingency plans, but that's it, one sentence, no guidelines, no help for the, for example, smaller member states. So you already can see there are some issues with this approach, no real coordination. Member states are left to themselves, some institutional chaos between the different players, no real clear distinction of roles, and also the heavy involvement of industry. All these private-public partnerships for information sharing and resilience and so on, it's always commission people, law enforcement people with industry. No civil society whatsoever, no user representations on board. So it could lead to what some people now call private policing, but what also was part of the big ACTA debate, for example, that ISPs and others should now be in charge of law enforcement on the internet. And then really scary for me is that the defense industry is now really heavily pushing into that policy field. All the big players like EADS, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, Thales, and so on, they regularly have cyber security conferences now in Brussels and come up with some kind of very expensive big scheme. Give us 10 or 100 million euros and we give you a big cybersecurity
snake oil.
Yeah.
They mean they don't
really
say
expensive
that,
snake
they mean
oil. And of course, snake oil that will in the end might lead to more data collection and data retention demands and so on.
As you may have heard, defense budgets all over the world are going down. Like, countries spend less money on defense this year than they did before. usually defense budgets just go up, but now they go down. But another budget that goes up is IT security budget. That goes up everywhere. So this is why the defense industry is trying to get into IT security topics, because they smell new income. Because they know that their classical budget they live from is getting smaller and smaller, and so they try to hijack the IT security industry to generate their revenue there.
Yeah, and then the traditional problem, especially for DG Information Society in Brussels, is regulatory capture. They are working so closely with industry, and there's also a revolving door. People from the commission move to industry, work there for a couple of years, and then go back to the commission and so on. That there's really no independent oversight or strong regulatory approaches towards industry in this field.
Yeah, for example, Commissioner Malmström also mentioned that she is against private policing and that she wants to prevent any form of private policing. But on the other hand, she or her department made, you know, proposals with this private-public partnership that could lead to private policing. So, you know, I'm not sure if this is just if they're as stupid, or if, you know, this is really some backdoor or something like that, that you say publicly one thing.
I mean, I think in some sense it makes sense to of course, cooperate with industry and with providers in this field, because they are the ones who run the systems and you know what's going on, but you really have to be careful how you do it.
Is there any questions? Raise your hand, I bring you the mic. No? Okay.
Next chapter, the virtual Schengen border. That was really funny last year, about a year ago, in April. Under the Hungarian Council presidency, the minutes of one meeting of the Council Law Enforcement Working Party, that's like a working group of the Council of Ministers, Home Affairs Ministers, on law enforcement, the minutes leaked on Statewatch, and I just got the Statewatch newsletter, and basically procrastinating, sitting in the office, and, okay, let's read the Statewatch letter before I do this really important thing, which my job asked me half an hour ago. So I read it, and I found this small paragraph just this year, point 8, cybercrime. The meeting was already in February, but the leak was in April. The presidency of the Law Enforcement Working Party presented its intention. The presidency of the Law Enforcement Working Party in that case is also a representative of the Hungarian presidency, council presidency. Presented its intention to propose concrete measures towards creating a single secure European cyberspace with a certain virtual Schengen border and virtual access points, whereby the internet service providers would block illicit contents on the basis of the EU blacklist.
Who of you is thinking about China now? Yeah, I thought that was also my first impression.
So I was like, what the fuck? What are they thinking? And then a bit later, I pointed this out to a couple of people in EDRI, got a leak of the presentation of this presidency presentation in the working group. And they really say, internet service providers are the virtual border crossing points at the EU's computer technology and internet borders.
So they need to station customs officers at your ISP in the future? What should they do? Listening on the cables if there is some illegal content?
So they also have these nice graphs that basically don't say much, but maybe...
This is the Chinese wall, part of the European wall?
Yeah.
Sorry?
Yes. Law enforcement agencies, courts, ISPs, and so on, that they all should feed into this EU blacklist of illicit content. Not just illegal content, but even illicit content. Yeah, so this took like 1 or 2 days, and it was all over the at least IT media and heavily debated in the blogosphere and so on. And then the Hungarian presidency was like,
Control Z.
And then they issued a corrigendum to the minutes of the law enforcement working party.
Was really mind-boggling, yeah.
it was not the council presidency, it was just a Hungarian expert. And he only presented certain ideas, not concrete measures. And ISPs only could log illicit content.
It was should before, you know.
And then they added this nice thing here, particular websites publishing pedophile material. Of course, that's always their latest excuse if they get some headwind. Oh no, we just want to fight the child molesters. Yeah, but basically this whole idea was dead the moment it was published and got leaked. And at the same time, last year we also managed to block the mandatory blocking of websites in the context of the Child Abuse Directive. It's now only optional. Some member states have already been doing it for a couple of years, UK and Sweden and others. Well, they still can do it now. We weren't able to prevent them from doing it, but we at least managed to make sure that countries who don't want to block, like Germany, don't have to do it now. But still, this blocking debate, of course, is not over. We also have it in ACTA. I said the notice and takedown regulations will come up this year. In the UK, we just had this court decision that CleanFeed, which was built up for blocking child abuse images, is now used for blocking the Pirate Bay. Which was, I think, a big marketing thing for Pirate Bay. They have more access than ever from the UK.
Plus 12 million users just because of that. That's free advertisement, I would say.
And it's also, I think, this whole thing of the virtual shame wall is an example of this border control mindset. We find a lot at the moment in EU home affairs debates with blocking, like the idea to have one open internal zone in the EU where people can more just freely travel. But then, you know, the idea is you have to have much stricter controls at the external borders with Frontex, with the new eFortress Europe they're setting up at the moment with the Smart Borders Package and Eurosur, where they want to have full surveillance of the Mediterranean Sea with drones and satellites and so on. So somehow some bureaucrat or whoever in the Hungarian presidency thought, okay, we also should do this for the internet. It's part of this mindset.
And the list there, ACTA, notice and takedown, initiatives, clean feed is not complete as the dots show in the end. There's iPred, for example, the same shit, partly from the cyber crime directive that was not going through, partly from ACTA and others, is in the iPred again. There's probably some other programs where they try to hide and sneak in their new world orders.
Okay, and then the fourth example or area, which I mentioned at the beginning, is the cybercrime directive or cyber attacks directive, which is at the moment being negotiated. It's part of criminal law. The EU now, with the Lisbon Treaty, has the competence to harmonize material, substantial criminal law in some cases where there's serious cross-border aspects, like human trafficking, drug trafficking, weapons, and so on, but also cybercrime. So this is, I think, the third, yeah, they already do, they had a directive on human trafficking, they had the child abuse directive last year, and now the cyber attacks directive is the third one in this field. It's basically based on the old Council of Europe Convention, the Cybercrime Convention from 2001, which was already back then heavily contested and fought by NGOs like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, because it criminalizes the possession of hacker tools. It also has some things on copyright violations. There's an additional protocol on racist and xenophobic propaganda via computer networks, which of course raises a lot of questions with regards to freedom of speech. But it is there since 2001, ratified by 18 EU member states. And based on this Council of Europe Convention, the EU came up with this Council Framework Decision in 2005. That was before Lisbon, so that was just exclusively done by the Home Affairs Ministers, Justice and Home Affairs Ministers, without the European Parliament. And that's basically where the German hacker paragraph, 202C in the German criminal code, came from. The debate we had, I think, three or four years ago, when was it? Where the CCC was also
involved. And that time it was like this cybercrime how is it called, convention. And this time it's a cybercrime directive. And the difference between a convention and
No, that's the convention is from the Council of Europe, which has nothing to do with the EU. It's a bigger institution, which also has members like Turkey, Russia, and so on. It's much bigger. It's not as strong and as binding as the EU. But based on the convention, because all of the EU member states are members of the Council of Europe also, they came up with this framework decision.
Yeah, but this new directive will become direct national law.
No, it has to be implemented in national
law. Yeah, of course. But but you cannot say anything, no, we don't implement or something like that.
Yeah, that was the difference. These old framework decisions, they had to be adopted by the national parliaments also. And now the new directive, which where the draft was presented in September 2010 by Mark Strill, they don't need unanimity in council anymore, so even if one or two member states are against it, there's a majority vote among the member states and a majority vote in the European Parliament, and then it has to be implemented on the national level. So it will basically change our criminal law. So what's in it? Well, they basically just tried the approach of more repression. Higher penalties of up to 5 years now instead of 3. Illegal interception is also supposed to be criminalized now, not just like hacking into a system or interfering with a system, deleting data or whatever, but also just intercepting it with no clear provisions on, okay, what about unencrypted Wi-Fi and stuff. Then it now also says hacker devices should be criminalized. Before it was just software, which already is a big problem, as you know, but now it was hacker devices.
Any idea what a hacker device is? Anyone? Keyboard. Keyboard is a good hacker device. A mobile phone. Yeah? Anything else? Yeah, the hub or the switch or the router could be a hacker device, sure. If it's a broken in Cisco.
We'll take you on the next slide what the commission response was to this question.
That's funny.
Then they also introduced more aggravating circumstances under which a crime is more serious and gets a higher penalty. Before that, in the old version of 2005, it was only if you do a computer crime in the context of organized crime, which I think you, if you accept the concept of organized crime, I think you can accept this also. But now it's also supposed to be aggravating circumstances when you use a stolen identity, which I think is a big problem because if I hack into a server somewhere, I automatically assume the identity of the admin of the server, right?
Or of some user first and then root, you know? So.
Yeah, and then there's one paragraph on botnets. If you run a large number of computer systems for committing this crime, then it's also aggravating circumstances. So the whole thing is not even written in a technology neutral way. But whatever. Yeah, then some other things. The member states are now supposed to set up 24/7 contact points to increase rapid response and so on, which might make sense. And some obligations for member states to do reporting and statistics, because most of the statistics out there on how serious is cybercrime in the first place are done by companies like Symantec and Norton and so on, and they're not really reliable. There are two studies, I think, one from Microsoft researchers and one from the Technical University of Delft, who looked into the methodology of all these cybercrime statistics, and they basically said it's just complete bullshit. So there's no real data there. And then it makes sense, of course, to have some obligations on member states to do comparative reporting. But the other ones were really like, yeah, one was, what the fuck? First of all, who ever believes that putting some more higher penalties and some more things into the criminal code of the EU member states has any effect and makes any impression on the really bad guys out there? And who really thinks that is really just naive?
Is there anyone in the room who thinks that higher the penalties will help in, you know, having effects on cybercrime? No one. Yeah. You're smart guys. Smarter than the European Commission, actually.
Yeah, and then, of course, hacker devices, like, what the fuck is that supposed to mean? So, when we had the first rounds of like discussion with the commission, I was in one of these sessions representing my boss because he was somewhere else, and I was asking them, what do you mean with these devices? And then for a while they didn't say anything, and then they came up with these things people put in front of ATMs to steal your PIN card for your credit card.
Skimming devices, right, that's how it's called.
Like, what? I mean, manipulation of ATMs is already a crime, so... yeah. And then, of course, we had a big discussion with them also on, as I mentioned, the interception thing. Am I a criminal now if I use an open Wi-Fi and just find on the street somewhere, things like that. And in general, our approach was, if you want to do anything for security in this field, you have to get to the root of the problem. I mean,
yeah, I mean, raising penalties, what they now do again or want to do again, they do already for the last decade. In the last 10 years or what, the penalties was raised and raised and raised. And if we look at the numbers on cybercrime, they raised and raised and raised. So hiring the penalties had no whatsoever effect. The opposite is true. They hired the penalties and they got more cybercrime. So I also asked that in the hearing of the parliament, do you think this helps? If you think that helps, look at the numbers, what you have done the last 10 years and what the reality tells you. I think that the root problem of cybercrime is vulnerable systems and sloppy administrative systems and things like that. I mean, behind every cybercrime, there is either a vulnerability in the software which somebody uses to its advantage, or there is a badly configured server where the administrator forgot to set the password or things like that, left the web directory open, left the backup there, things like that. Yeah, for example. Actually, if you're using botnets, and since this is giving you higher penalties, you could just use the cloud. Not mentioned in the law, has the same effect. I think that if you really want to do something in cybercrime, and if you really want to lower the numbers of crime that happens, you need to do something about the system security. And to do that, you need to change the economic equation, because nowadays vendors of software usually ship banana software, how we call it. Banana software is software that gets ready when it's already at your computer. So they ship buggy software, then they find out, oh, it's buggy, oh, let's patch it and roll out a patch. And so the software gets ready while you already working with it. That is banana software, because bananas also get on the ship while they're green, and then they get ready and yellow on the way to the supermarket near you. And why software vendors do things like that? You know why? Any idea? Yeah, it's cheaper for them, but why the car manufacturers don't do it? Time to market could be, but why the car manufacturers also have this time to market problem? Why they don't do it? They have liability. And you ever, I know most of you may click it away, the software end user license agreements. There's always this one sentence. This software is provided without any liability. And that's the problem. Because if you change liability for software vendors, and they're as liable for their software as car manufacturers are liable for broken or not working brakes on their cars or things like that, you change the economic equation. Nowadays, it's cheaper for software vendors not to care too much about security. They have faster time to market. They don't have to spend that much money. They don't have to engage highly skilled and highly paid security consultants or something like that. You know, it's cheaper for them. But But if you make them liable, then insurance companies will step in and the shareholders will have an interest in the company has not to, is not liable, does not produce faulty products. And then the company itself, the software vendor, becomes a strong interest in producing more secure software. And I think we should do the same in terms of data protection. If somebody is doing systems and is not taking care, appropriate care on data protection, we should also hold them liable. This will change the economic equation for the businesses, and this will make them move.
We are working on that also.
We are working on that.
The chief negotiator for the European Parliament, rapporteur, as they call it, for the data protection revision, the big project just started earlier this year. And in the draft from the Commission, there's penalties of up to 2% of the global annual turnover of the company in case of severe data breaches and so on. So we try to inflict some pain on them if they don't behave. So some other things we also said, if you want to strengthen prevention and security at the root, you also have to protect the white hat hackers, people who just find out vulnerabilities and actually tell the people who produce them or produce the software and who run the systems about them. You have to protect them as the immune system and not criminalize them, not even by accident.
A huge problem, the new directive, for example, makes it illegal to pass on passwords or PIN codes or credentials. Most of you from Germany will have heard about this telecom router bug lately, where there was this company backdoor of the vendor with a 4-6-digit PIN or something like that. So the student who found the bug tried to report it responsibly to the vendor. The vendor did not move for over 1 year. So then he sent it to the US CERT. The US CERT tried to make the vendor patch it. The vendor was not moving. So the US CERT followed its policy, which is quite cool for a US government CERT, to publish the information even though the bug was not fixed yet. This is what they do if the company is not moving, which I think is a good policy. And then when it was public, because of the US CERT published the information, the attack details and also the PIN code, they had to patch it. But if this directive would have been in place, like the proposal was, the company who produced the bug in the routers of the telecom could go after the student with lawyers, and it would have been much cheaper than fixing the bug and rolling out the patch. And to admit to their customers like Telecom, oh, sorry, we have a backdoor in our product. Yes, it affects all your customers. No, we haven't told you. Oops. It's cheaper to send lawyers after the student who found the bug. And this new directive would have given them the possibility to prosecute this student because he had to give away the PIN code for this vendor backdoor. Because without the PIN code, the information, the bug, is not reproducible by others and cannot be proved to be existing. And when you're from academia, you know that you always have to document all the details to reproduce it. It's very important. This directive could make things like that illegal, which is really, really bad for cybersecurity.
I think we have to move a bit quicker. Maybe a short thing on the timing, because we only were able to start like 15 minutes late, because Malta was only able to start 15 minutes late, because a 2 hour panel on copyright took longer than supposed.
Yeah, let's go on.
We will take a bit longer, so everybody who's here for the next talk, please be a bit patient. But we still have to speed up a bit, I think. So what we try, because it's a criminal law directive, it can only work with criminal law terms, we try to introduce the concept of alleviating circumstances. So if you hack into a system, and you can do that because it's wide open and has unpatched known security vulnerabilities for the last year or something, this is considered an alleviating circumstance, and you get a lower penalty. Mildernde Umstände in German. And then we also try to introduce some liability for operators and vendors of systems when, at least when as a result of an attack, considerable damage is caused. fahrlässig halte, negligent. So, how did we do that? Pretty easy. Actually, the people in the Home Affairs Committee of the European Parliament, the Home Affairs Committee, they know me by now. I've been working there for almost 3 years now, and they know that I hang out with the internet community somewhat. So they asked me, hey, Ralf, can you get us a CCC member for the hearing? I was like, yes. So I called Scoozy, and Scoozy said yes.
And the fun began.
Yeah.
So first of all, I have to tell you from this experience, it's hard to explain things like that to politicians in Brussels, because they basically have no clue whatsoever. They don't understand the root problem, which I already outlined. They don't have enough clue of cyberspace and basic principles. They don't know how software engineering is working, how the immune system of the internet, this full disclosure and responsible disclosure, and researchers finding bugs and publishing them to make us all more safe works. So I first had to address those issues to enable them to at least be able to understand the problem. The next thing was that basic principles and also descriptions of what is a vulnerability, what is a bug, what is an exploit, what is an attack, how they interconnect with each other, is I had to explain. The IT security ecosystem, full disclosure and things like that, how it works, how vendors react and why, and that's their strategy they had so far, which I already told you, hiring up the penalties will not help at all. What I tried is make it understandable for them. I used analogies from the real world. I know they suck, and I know that it's always a little bit wrong also. But I don't know any better way to explain pure analog people digital things or things about the internet. So for example, I use the analogy of electromagnetic emissions. If you receive electromagnetic emissions from a computer system, it is illegal after the new directive. And this is similar to something, you know, I'm standing here and shouting out a secret. Something is top secret, for example. And I tell it right now to you. You can be prosecuted from this directive because you have heard it. I don't. I just shouted it out. It's weird, isn't it? Yeah, but they make weird laws like that. So I compared that with somebody shouting secrets onto the streets or something and asked them what they think should be done. And they said, yeah, the guy who's shouting out the secret needs to be prosecuted. Right, but you prosecute everyone on the street who heard it. Publishing password and PIN codes. I asked them, if you lose or get the key to your apartment stolen, what do you do? Do you make a law and trust that because the law makes it illegal to pass on the key to somebody else or to use it to break into your house? You know, they just don't do it because there's a law. Or do you switch the keys or the locks in your apartment? You know, probably everyone is exchanging the lock. And this is what you should do with computer systems too. You should just change the password or change the SSH key or whatever it is and not make it illegal to pass on the already known PIN code of some company backdoor or something. And I compared hacker tools to knives you can use to prepare bread with butter and salami or whatnot. And you can also use it to kill somebody or to harm somebody. And a knife should not be illegal because you can harm somebody with it. The intention or the actual action to harm somebody with a knife should be illegal. So that is something they understood. They are not really brave when it comes to things that are hard to do, like software liability or liability for software vendors. They're afraid of the software companies and lobbyists. And you know, the press actually asked Malmström if she will take the bull at the horn and address that issue, and she said no. Yeah, so they are not even willing to address the root cases.
So we are trying to push them from the parliament. So based on all these debates, we tried, because it's a legislative process, you have to table amendments to the draft text from the commission. We tabled a number of amendments, also sometimes together with the other political groups, to improve this directive. So we made clear that all these activities are only can only be prosecuted if you do them with criminal intent. That is actually already in the old 2001 Cybercrime Convention of the Council of Europe. But it was not in the draft directive from Malmström. Then we put a clause in that all these measures shall only be incriminating when the offense is committed by infringing a security measure. So just using an unencrypted Wi-Fi is not criminal. Using an unencrypted TV satellite, as we heard yesterday from Andreas, is not criminal. But only if there's a clear security measure which at least makes clear that the people who run this system think that others should be kept outside, no matter how effective it is. Then we had a clause on protection for white hat hackers, a minor case, and these are cases where there is no need, at least not necessarily, to prosecute them. One of the minor case provisions was, suggested, was when the access was without right, access to the IT system. But the only purpose was to inform the operator of the vulnerability and no damage was caused. And then we had a funny thing which the EFF told us. I didn't really notice that at first reading, but the EFF had the problem in the US already, and they told us, watch out guys, because there was a clause on unauthorized access of an IT system, which also should be made criminal. And the USA, they already have this in the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for a number of years, and this has been abused by companies and by employers. So they say, if you use my web service, whatever, Twitter, stuff like that, and use it against the terms of service, it's an unauthorized access, and you can end up in the criminal court. Just by breaching the terms of service. If you have a computer at your workplace, but your employer tells you you can only use the computer for work-related purposes, not for your private emails or Facebook or whatever, but you still do it, then you could end up in front of a criminal judge, not just in front of a labor judge. So we make sure that this is clarified, as these cases, of course, should not be covered by a criminal law directive. And then on the hacker tool, Article 7, we tabled an amendment to completely delete it, of course, but we didn't get a majority for that. So in the end, the compromise was that it has to be clearly designed for the purpose of committing one of these offenses. And the possession still would be illegal, but only the distribution would be illegal if you distribute it with a clear purpose that somebody commits one of these crimes. So if you just distribute it without any knowledge of people who download it or whatsoever, and most of them use it for download it for testing of their systems and so on, you should be fine. This was a vote, I think, end of March, a couple of weeks ago, where the reporting about this started. I got a number of requests from the hacker community, hey guys, what's going on there? The problem was that there were a lot of amendments voted on, and then it takes a couple of weeks for our committee secretariat to put together the consolidated version that was actually voted at the end. But that was not ready when the right after the vote, so people were reporting based on the original proposal from the commission, which is not the latest state of the debate. And then we tried to work on incentives for better security with the alleviating circumstances I already mentioned, and then also with the provision that member states now should explore at least proportionate and effective sanctions against persons that market and operate information systems which are evidently defective or which have proven security vulnerabilities. Okay, so state of affairs now. So this is basically what we got in the negotiations with the other political parties. It's not what, the best thing, I think. It's not what we tried to do, but it was a compromise that we were able to reach also with the conservatives.
That was all we could do under the circumstances to minimize harm, but at least it minimized harm.
So state of play now is that with this position, the rapporteur of the parliament, which is Monika Hohlmeier from the German Conservatives, some are laughing, but actually she did a pretty good job in this process, I really have to say. She really listened to our concerns, our arguments, and she's now really trying to defend this position in the negotiations with the member states, which are going on at the moment. The last round of negotiations was this Wednesday, so next one will be... last one was this week, yeah. The next one will be on 4th of June, and that may also probably be the end of the story. The main conflict lines, I could tell on Wednesday in the negotiations, were the protection of white hat hackers, the minor case if you break into a system, but only to inform the operator of a vulnerability and don't cause any damage. Member states don't want to have this exception clause in, so we really have to fight to keep it in. Then the thing with attacks against information systems should only be criminalized if you infringe a security measure. The member states want to delete the at least. So, punishable as a criminal offense. No, we want to delete the at least, yeah. So it says it's punishable as a criminal offense when committed by infringing a security measure. That would be only when infringing a security measure. Member states want to have the at least in, so that means they have to do this, but they can also criminalize people who just use an open Wi-Fi or break into an open system.
I guess
it's also have to fight for keeping the at least out. On hacker tools, there's a funny thing here, because the majority in the parliament, unfortunately, wanted to also have a minimum penalty for the distribution of hacker tools of at least, it's not really a minimum penalty, it's this weird concept of minimum maximum penalty. So the maximum penalty for this kind of crime has to be at least 2 years. And member states wanted this, no, the parliament unfortunately wanted this, but now the member states somehow have an issue with this clause and want to have no minimum penalties for distribution of hacker tools. So in this case, it might help to call the German government or other national governments and tell them, hey, you have to fight against the position of the parliament here. And on better security, the obligation to protect data from offenses, having regard to state of the art and so on, and the alleviating circumstances when known vulnerabilities are not fixed, is also something we really have to fight to make sure it stays in. Member states are also not really interested in these issues. They, as Scusi said, they're not willing to take the bull by the horns.
No, at least they say so. I don't think they are doing.
So what's possible now? It's not possible to approve anything in this directive which is not already on the negotiation table. So they're at the very last stage of the negotiations. So we can only work with stuff that's already on the table, which the member states or the parliament want to change in the draft from the commission. So that means we have to defend what we already got. We can't try to get more, it's not possible at this stage. So if you want to help, you can contact the members of parliament in charge. Monika Hohlmeier, as I said, is the rapporteur, so she is the one negotiating with the council presidency, but the other ones are always sitting in the back and listening and sure that she doesn't do any bad deals, which so far hasn't happened. But you can also call them, send them an email and say, here, please stick to this and this and this, what the parliament wanted. And as I said, there's not much time left. The next and maybe last round of negotiations is 4th of June. So next time, please, if things like this are coming up, start a bit earlier. Don't only ask me or others when the vote in the committee has already taken place, because then it's already too late.
Okay. So, we overdid 1 minute and 15 seconds. The funny side effects.
Yeah.
Very, very briefly. Because because of I was at this Libye hearing, I could
see the Committee for Civil Liberties, Justice and Home Affairs.
Thank you. I could see how the defense industry tries to get into IT security business. I got a date with Mrs. Malmström because of this Bull by the Horn taking questions from the press. He was suddenly interested in at least talking to me. A job offer from Europol, which I didn't take. And you also
because
don't
they
get real money there. And a Thai accession in the Ukraine to tell Ukrainian policymakers about cybercrime, which was kind of interesting. And some other interesting discussions. The most funny was probably the meeting with Ms. Malmström, but I think it has not been that effective. The first question was, can you explain what is the difference between this vulnerability, O-Day, and attack? They don't understand. You know, but she's doing the laws for all European citizens on that.
Okay, quick conclusions. The overall picture, we try to tell you what's going on at the EU level in this field, information, coordination, some agencies and approaches, private-public partnerships, and novel cyber crime, criminal law approaches. Bottom line, there's no real coordination. A lot of this is done in an autocracy way. Most of the activities are addressing the symptoms, you know, coordinating when there's an attack happening and so on, but not really going at the root cause. A lot of private-public partnership ideology, shying away from hard measures, from going at the root. And as I said, as you saw on the virtual Schengen border part, border control ideology, the European external borders also.
The Chinese wall on the internet.
Things like that.
So you could say this is somewhat typical for EU policies. A lot of stuff is going on in different parts of the Commission, in different agencies, in different working groups of agencies and partnerships with industry and so on. So, and all of that is not always, or most of the time, not really coordinated. And but I think you could also say it's typical for cyber policies. If you look at the US or other countries, they also have this kind of piecemeal approach very often. So if you compare it to CISPA and these really evil things going on in the US at the moment, I think we are still in a pretty good peaceful situation here. Yeah, and the other thing?
Yeah, they're actually a little bit more open than national parliaments, was my impression. Even Mrs. Hohlmeier from the CSU, very conservative from Bavaria, daughter of a well-known German politician that is called a hardliner, Mr. Strauss. Was actually quite open-minded and was one of the few guys there really listening and really thinking about it and also willing to change their proposal when she thought it could be better to do what experts say. Tech stuff is hard to explain, I told you already. The main problem is still the Commission and the member states. And we definitely have to watch the civilians and military industrial complex because they try to get into this field heavily.
Okay, that was it. Thanks for listening. I'm afraid we don't have any time for questions. But
you can hunt us